We actually have to stop dictatorship. That's what it's about. I'm all for leadership, but this is a dictatorship.
We can't switch back to normal. We've got to find a COVID normal.
President Trump was waging war with Twitter.
What they're doing is tantamount to monopoly, you could say. It's tantamount to taking over the airwaves.
The Wrap.
Yeah, it's that time on Friday where we delve into some of the week's biggest stories with people who know them best. Today, we're very lucky to have two experts in their respective fields. Dr. Nikki Stamp is a cardiothoracic surgeon and author. She's also been a TV presenter hosting the ABC's Catalyst. And renowned journalist and author Peter Grester, who is a UNESCO chair in journalism at the University of Queensland, also joins us. Welcome to both of you.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Let's start with you, Peter. This week, the Australian Federal Police ruled out laying charges against News Corp journalist Annika Smethurst. This was over those stories she published in 2018 that relied on classified intelligence documents. How significant was this announcement from the AFP?
Look, I think it was important without getting too excited about it because it wasn't dropped over principled reasons. The Federal Police said that they decided not to go ahead with the case because they didn't have enough evidence to prosecute anybody. They didn't back away from it because they felt that there was, or acknowledged that there was, a higher principle involving press freedom here. And so it was an important victory, but it also underscores, I think, the need for serious legislative reform so that we don't get this kind of crisis again, where legitimate journalism that's exposing stories genuinely in the public interest and that isn't undermining national security or anyone's safety becomes criminalised. That's what we really need to see the end of. Now, as I said, this was a step forward, but that it also underlines just how much further we need to go to make sure that press freedom in this country is genuinely protected.
Well, at the same time, there's still an ongoing investigation into ABC journalists Dan Oakes and Sam Clark regarding a separate leak of documents known as the Afghan files, as you know. And the AFP in the press conference about Annika Smethurst confirmed that that's still ongoing. They still don't know anything about their fate.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, again, that's why this is a small victory, not the end of the road. Their situation, again, underlines the ambiguity that we're facing. I actually think the Federal Police themselves would welcome some clarity over this. This whole case has brought them brought a lot of pressure on them. It's brought accusations that they've made. They've been involved in political inquiries, going after journalists who are covering stories that were uncomfortable for the press. And I think that if we had legislative reform that made it much clearer what their responsibilities were and gave journalists the space that they need to investigate government and to keep the system honest, then I think it would be far more effective for everyone concerned.
The other element, of course, here is that, you know, this was being pushed very strongly by journalists and media organisations. Then COVID-19 happened and it seems lots of things have been dropped. Do you think there is an appetite for reform here, Peter Grester?
Well, we've got two parliamentary inquiries currently underway, one by the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security and another one in the Senate, and both are due to report in the next few weeks and months. They wouldn't be there. They wouldn't be happening if there wasn't some genuine political interest in this. But at the same time, we're seeing legislation continually being passed that undermines press freedom. And so while I think there's an interest in being seen to tackle the problem, we don't yet see a shift in the political will. Now, I'm not going to jinx it. I'm not going to suggest that it won't happen. But the appetite, the momentum at the moment seems to be towards introducing ever more stricter and, in the view of myself and a lot of my colleagues, more draconian legislation that winds up limiting press freedom, not opening it up.
Nikki, I want to bring you in with your big story that you've been watching closely. This week, the Australian Medical Association gave a warning about the importance of a strong pro-vaccine information campaign. Why are the AMA getting into this?
Well, I think that a lot of people see the AMA largely as a representative body for doctors, which is true. That is a large part of their role. But they also have a really important role in protecting the health of Australians at large, including lobbying for better health access for many Australians, in fact. And I think it's really important that we have a body that is generally, I think, pretty well respected, that is well credentialed to be having an opinion on this matter, weighed into this debate about effective health and science communication. And as we've sort of already touched on, COVID-19 has really changed the world. And given that we have an infectious disease here, and we know that we've successfully in the past eradicated a number of infectious diseases or controlled them using vaccination, you know, it is an important time to be having this discussion. And, you know, sadly, I think COVID has certainly brought a lot of these issues around health misinformation to light. And it is important that we have a strong, politically neutral, but scientifically based voice in this space.
Is one of the problems here the idea that factual scientific information isn't always the most entertaining and engaging content?
I don't think it is. I'm talking to my mum, surrounded by textbooks, and they are about as dry as they come. So then to try and relay that information to the general public in a way that is understandable, that is engaging and effective, is actually really difficult. And particularly, you know, we have a really broad community in age, education, expectations, needs in terms of health communication, and we do need to be able to tap into those groups, I suppose, within the population, their individual needs and wants when it comes to health communication. But I do think particularly for younger people, you know, that health communication is really dry and boring, and therefore it's very easy to lose your audience in that regard. You know, we know that in younger people, so teenagers, for example, they don't want health information from someone like me. They don't want it from their parents. They want it from someone who's relatable, perhaps from a peer, whereas if you look at the older population, they're more likely to take their information from someone like me. And you know, I think it is high time that we try and you know, improve science communication and health communication, that it is engaging, it's not paternalistic, and is much, much more effective.
Like, for instance, like this.
I'm on TikTok. Yes, I'm on TikTok at Mom and Dr. Jones. But this video is going to be going through some TikToks. Obviously, no shade to any of these people. Don't go give them hate. This one is titled Placenta Black Market and has 1.1 million views. As I do with all things that I talk about on this channel, I tried to research this a little bit.
Okay, so that's Dr. Danielle Jones, who's amassed a huge online following. Is that the future of science communication?
I think it could well be. I mean, Dr. Jones is a friend and colleague of mine, and she's doing an extraordinary job in the health communication space. She's an obstetrician gynecologist. She spends a lot of time on TikTok, YouTube, Instagram, really debunking a lot of health myths, particularly for women's health, which is, you know, really ripe for the taking in the face of misinformation. So I think that skilled, relatable, engaging and also, you know, factual communication style that Danielle and a lot of other doctors and scientists are using in social media is something that we should aim to emulate, both at an individual level. I'm very big at encouraging doctors, for example, onto social media for the purposes of public communication if it's done well. But I think also we probably have a lot to learn in terms of public health campaigning from successful people like at Mama Dr. Jones.
If you're just tuning in, this is RN Drive, and we're talking about some big stories you may have missed this week. Peter Gresta is one of our guests. So is Nikki Stamp. Peter, let's talk about Kylie Moore-Gilbert. The Australian academic has been imprisoned in Iran for more than 600 days on spying allegations. And this week, a small group of her supporters penned an anonymous statement, which, as some listeners might have heard on RN Breakfast yesterday, calls on the Australian government to lobby for her immediate release. Why are her supporters becoming more vocal now?
Well, the two big reasons. One is that it was her 33rd birthday yesterday, and they felt that it was time to speak up. The other reason was because we haven't heard anything from the government, from the family, from anybody about about her situation. And I've been getting a lot of notes, a lot of emails and messages from people, from friends, from colleagues, from people who are concerned about her, asking why we're not seeing a much more vocal campaign. Now, people remember the scale of the campaign that backed me when I was in prison in Egypt. That was an extraordinarily vocal campaign. We had my own professional colleagues speaking long and loudly about it. We had a lot of journalists that were speaking about it. My family, of course, was famously vocal about all of it. But in Kylie's case, her imprisonment seems every bit as unjust as mine was, and yet there has been no communication whatsoever. I think a lot of people are getting incredibly frustrated by the time that she spent in prison, and feeling that if the silent kind of strategies that the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade have been adopting to try and get her out haven't worked until now, then it's time to change the tactics.
Does the situation show Canberra's lack of leverage over Iran? Are we actually in a position to do more?
Well, I wish I could give you a clear answer to that. What we heard yesterday was an interview on Breakfast with Jason Rezaian, who was a Washington Post correspondent who was also imprisoned in Iran. He was an Iran specialist. And his view was that Australia does have leverage. His view also is that a vocal campaign is likely to have an effect. There was certainly a lot of people who were speaking loudly in support of him. He obviously also had his own professional colleagues advocating for him. And he felt that it had a clear impact on his own situation, and he felt that he would still be in prison if it weren't for that. I'm not an Iran expert. I cannot speak about the amount of leverage that Australia has in Iran, but I do know that in Egypt we had little or no leverage, no formal leverage, and that I'm absolutely convinced that I'd still be there if it weren't for that vocal campaign.
Yeah, look, I think that's right. I think that campaign was, incredibly strong around what was happening to you, Peter, and I think that there's no doubt that had enormous impact.
There was, DFAT's first instinct is always going to be treating this as a diplomatic problem and using the diplomatic tools that they have available. But I'm absolutely clear that I'd still be there without it.
Now, Nikki, let's just stick with this discussion on facts and importance and transparency, because something extraordinary happened this week that you noticed, so did I, and it's actually even gotten more intense tonight. President Donald Trump was this week fact-checked by Twitter, which is pretty, new. Today, which I think is extraordinary, and this is what's broken this afternoon, Twitter has also ruled that one of the president's latest tweets on the protests in Minneapolis violated their rules on glorifying violence. And let's just have a moment to think about that. This is the president of the United States of America, and Twitter, the platform he has used so much to really, it's so, I think it's, what he's used to rise, saying that his tweet as the president glorified violence. In the tweet, he says, when the looting starts, the shooting starts, and suggested the military could get involved in this protest. This is all unfolding right now. This is huge, isn't it?
I think this is massive because we do know that there has been a lot of calls, and again, COVID-19 has sort of catalyzed some of this for better online fact checking and I think control of false information. The WHO reported very early on in the pandemic that we were battling a concurrent infodemic with huge amounts of false information spreading around the internet, and has partnered with Google and Facebook initially to try and combat this. But we also do know that for a long time, I think that it's probably accurate to say that most social media platforms have been, really kind of inactive against fact-checking people online. They have, varying degrees of reporting for you if you want to report false information. And then, Instagram brought it in last year, but even reporting that information on Instagram as false doesn't guarantee you a review, and it certainly doesn't guarantee that it's going to be taken taken down. So the fact that Twitter have moved against the president, and the initial tweet that they declared as inaccurate was actually his tweets on postal voting, because as we know, the presidential election's coming up. COVID is going to change how an already difficult to vote system is going to affect the outcome, because people don't know. So I think it's on a Tuesday. A lot of people are deterred to go and vote, and then of course we possibly will have social distancing in place still in the US. We don't really know. And the alternative is mail voting, which President Trump is saying is ripe for postal vote fraud. And Twitter fact checked that and said it's not right. So of course then the president, I think it's to be expected. He's been a little bit petulant by trying to alter some legislation that absolves these platforms of some responsibility about fact checking, that they're just a conduit rather than actual publishers of these information. So Twitter has fired back and I think rightly so pointed out that this tweet where he said, the looting starts, the shooting starts, it does glorify violence. I think it's just unconscionable that a world leader would encourage, yeah, such aggressive military action against their own citizens in the setting, one, of a pandemic, and two, an absolutely dreadful event, the murder really of George Floyd. So I think it's sort of starting to be a bit of a tit for tat. But I think it's really great that Twitter has stood up, and I think this should be a wake up call to everyone who's a social media user. We have a responsibility to put out appropriately factual, non-harmful information, and that even the President of the United States is not immune from fact-checking and being responsible, being a responsible social media user.
Peter Grest, a final word to you on that, yeah.
Yeah, just look, to be clear, that Twitter wasn't taking down President Trump's tweets. It wasn't censoring.
No.
All they were doing was sticking an exclamation mark at the end of his tweet saying that it had been fact-checked. And if you clicked on that, and you had to voluntary click on it, it took you to another page with a whole host of news stories that challenged or that gave what we consider to be the truth about the matter. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that. We need a fight back for facts. Mm. And this goes back to what Nikki was talking about earlier, that simply allowing people to spout rubbish without having the opportunity to present solid factual basis to their claims, mm, and seeing and allowing scientific consensus to come through means that we've got at least a vague chance, an outside chance, of putting a brake on the infodemic that Nikki spoke of so eloquently.
Look, yeah, absolutely agree wholeheartedly, and I think it's also important that we don't shy away from that. It's the research is increasingly showing that debunking these kinds of things with factual information is a really important way. So I think bravo, Twitter.
Look, guys, you've been great guests tonight. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks
so much.
Dr. Nikki Stamp is a cardiothoracic surgeon and author, and Peter Grester is a journalist and author who's also the UNESCO Chair of Journalism at the University of Queensland.